Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com, as well as podcasting these programs on SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, Spotify, Player FM, Blueberry, and many others. And we thank those who are distributing our programs because it's getting the word out. It's letting people know. And speaking of getting the word out, we're getting the word out that 2020 is the year of perfect vision. Have you got that? It's the year of perfect vision. And we're not talking about your ophthalmologist testing you for anything. We're talking about that inner vision and guidance that we talk about on a regular basis, your intuition that leads you in a perfect way. And so we hope that you will participate over the course of the 12 months of 2020, as we bring programs to you that will help to fine-tune, if you will, or focus your vision, your 2020 vision. We also want to let you know that if you would like to support what we do, if you'd like to be a part of the 2020 Perfect Vision year, if you will, financially, we'll be greatly appreciative thereof. We have a PayPal and Patreon account, and you can support us through those, and any amount is greatly and graciously received. Today's program is about, we're going to go to school. That's right. And I'm going to get schooled, I guarantee you, because it's not, we're going to be taking a foreign language here. It's not one that I've ever taken before. I've heard words from this language, but I've also heard of the level of importance of this language to our, I'm going to say our well-being, to our spiritual growth. I've heard that by studying this language, it can rewrite the synapses of the brain, rewrite pathways for higher consciousness. We're going to be talking about consciousness, confidence, consciousness, confidence. We're going to be learning how to use the wisdom of Sanskrit to find clarity and success. Sarah Maine's my guest all the way from Sydney, Australia. And thank you for joining us from tomorrow.
Well, thank you very much for that wonderful welcome. It's wonderful to be with you.
Why did you choose, and this is actually a question that's kind of weird to ask, why did you choose Sanskrit as a language to study and make such a huge integral part of your life?
Well, you know, people say Sanskrit chose me.
That's why I said it was a funny question.
Yeah. Look, I came across Sanskrit when I was young. My parents were very keen seekers of wisdom. They wanted to know things. This was back in the late 1960s. There was a lot of investigation and searching. And it was really through that, it was just an ordinary suburban household. It was nothing odd. But I came across Sanskrit and was introduced to Sanskrit in simple ways, you know, much like people would know these days, the odd word, a phrase, whatever, because it's embodied in a lot of the wisdom traditions, particularly of the East. And I just loved it. Look, I was young, but I loved music, and there's a musicality in Sanskrit and a beauty in the sound, and that was my first connection with it, and it was deep and abiding. And then when I started studying it, and I loved languages, so I studied Latin and German and I loved studying English and grammar and so on. I started studying Sanskrit, and I loved the grammar. I just loved the etymology, just everything about it. And it was so satisfying and interesting and stimulating and beautiful at the same time. That had just the total, complete package of interest and connection and nourishment and everything. And I just followed that. You know, and I found everything I needed was there in Sanskrit. And so, you know, then I followed it into university and beyond. And it's, I hadn't really looked at it for a while formally. And then when I started looking into the whole concept of confidence, and there was a sort of bit of a circular route how I ended up coming back to looking at the word confidence in particular, There's a sort of story behind that. When I looked into what does the Sanskrit say about confidence, that was my question. And, you know, Sanskrit, when it presents a meaning of something, it's really from the point of view of what it does. It's experiential rather than conceptual. And that's a fundamental difference in Sanskrit. You know, when we talk about table, usually we just think of an object. It's a concept. Whereas Sanskrit comes from the other way, it comes from the point of view that a table is something that is tabling, the act of tabling. It's in the action, the activity. A mother is the act of mothering rather than a concept. And it was that I thought, well, what is happening within us when we are confident? What is actually going on? And when we don't feel confident, what's missing? And when I went back and looked up the words confidence in Sanskrit, I discovered there were about 10 or 12 words, all describing different aspects and elements of confidence. And when I went back through into the deeper etymology, which is how I was trained, and suddenly the lights went on, I thought, oh, blimey, now I get it. And I suddenly, and then the whole, my FUSE Fuse program, just suddenly it was all there. And I just, that's how I've derived it from the Sanskrit.
When you talk about the definitions of words, which we do regularly on this program, and it's one of the things I love to do is define terms, define words.
Yeah.
And also talking about translations from one language to another.
Yes.
In my case, from any other language into English. The limited study of Hebrew, for example, that I have done, of the alphabet, is that each letter has its own legend. It has its own story. It has its own color, its own number, its own vibratory tone, and so forth. Then you start putting those letters, those characters, together into words, a whole new legend. Put those words into sentences, again, a new legend, to paragraphs, new legend, to chapters, and to a book. Again, it's the same thing. However, when you translate it out of that language into any other language, you lose the legend.
Yeah.
How is it that you, or how do you, I guess is a better way to put this, how do you maintain the, shall we call it, the cohesiveness and or integrity of Sanskrit and its genuine meaning from Sanskrit, in this case, into English? How is that done so as to preserve, quote unquote, the legend of the characters, the words, the sentences, paragraphs, so forth, so that the intent of the writer of that is maintained?
Well, firstly, I'd like to thank you for such a wonderful, beautiful, excellent question. Thank you very much for that. I've never been asked that before, and it's a great question. Well, there's many ways of answering that. To start with, you need to go back and have a connection with what the Sanskrit is saying, and that comes from within. So you need to go deeper into the etymology, what the word is actually saying, and get and endeavor to get past all the filters that inevitably we have. And that was one of the reasons for studying Sanskrit, was to get back to the actual meaning of something in some form of purity rather than being colored and distorted by our filters that we have in our normal linguistic system and our mindset and belief systems and so on. So there's an aspect of reflection or contemplation or meditation, if you will, on the words themselves. And then I found when I was translating texts all you can do is your best effort, obviously, is have a deeper connection to what the word or the text might be saying, And then from a point of inner stillness, allow then the translation, the appropriate, the correct translation to then arise and present in the mind rather than thinking it through, which is usually a recipe for laying over a whole lot of filters and distortions. Allow then the words to present, and they do, because the mind is a beautiful instrument. It gets a bad rap these days in the sort of personal development space and the mindfulness space, but it's a beautiful instrument when it's still and used properly. And then the mind presents what the translation should be. When I was at university, there was a passage from the Upanishads that we were translating that particular week. And seriously, there were two quite different translations for it that were both supported by the grammar and the etymology, 100%. I'd never come across that before. And I presented that to my lecturer in the next class. And I said, well, both these translations technically are correct according to the grammar. I said, what do you do? How do you choose? And he looked at me with a wry smile and he said, aha, Sarah. He said, this is how you get different schools of thought, different schools of philosophy arising, where one person will take one and say that this is absolutely correct and the wisdom tradition scriptures support that. And then another person will say, this one's correct. And in their own rights, both are correct, but it just depends what you personally connect with, which I thought was a very interesting situation.
Well, indeed. And of course, then that also sets us up for a lot of what we experience in this day and age with the plethora of philosophies and also the plethora of confusion.
Yes.
Because you don't know who to listen to.
Yes.
And what to read, which is one of the reasons why I'm fortunate in my career and in what I'm doing today with this program that I get to talk to you and find out about conscious confidence and learning Sanskrit and its importance and the value both physiologically as well as spiritually. Whereas, you know, I would have to sit down and actually read through from first page to last in order to get the gist of it. and so I'm lucky from that standpoint. And that's not to say that I don't have a chance to read through certain portions of the books that I do receive. But, there are so many. It's like I would have to retire for the next 500 years in order to read all of the books that I've received.
Yes.
So I've given that up. I don't beat myself up over the head for not having read a lot of the classics. I did finally read Stranger in a Strange Land.
Right.
It came out in Audible. I actually have a hard copy of it. It's in paperback. Yeah. And it's very thick. And I was reading it and slowly, but I got the Audible and I read it. It took me a couple of 3 months to read through it because I kept going back and rereading sections. And I, first of all, I have to say on that book, I loved the overall story. I hated the ending. Did not like the ending. But at least I can say I've read it. And one word in that book, it's not the only takeaway, mind you. But the one word I do take away from that book is the word to grok. And to me, the definition based upon that book is to assimilate into every cell in our bodies.
Yes.
The meaning of whatever it is we're trying to understand. Yes. So as you have studied for obviously many years Sanskrit. When you first, let's look at it from day one of your study of Sanskrit. And obviously you're looking at a bunch of these squiggly lines on a page. I mean, I have as much understanding of when I look at the text of Sanskrit as I do of any Middle Eastern language.
Yeah.
You know, I have no clue whether it's or if it's Indian or what have you. What was your, obviously you said you had the desire, you were searching and you were curious, but when you first saw Sanskrit, what was your first impression?
Oh, it was just so beautiful. It was beautiful. I mean, I was fortunate that the lettering, just at the level of the lettering, the form of the lettering that I was very first presented with was a beautiful rendering of it, very calligraphic and very beautiful. And, you know, what's not to like? It's lovely to look at. I've taught children Sanskrit for years, and they love the shapes of it. It's lovely to write. It's really nice, you know. And I've met a lot of people with Sanskrit tattoos who have no idea what the tattoo is.
Oh, wow.
And yet they've put it on their bodies, and some of it, quite a lot of it, which amazes me, quite a lot of it, they have no idea what it means. But they just loved the look of it.
Yeah. I can only imagine you come across somebody who's got one of these tattoos of Sanskrit. Do you understand that what you have on your arm there, that's mud. That says mud.
Usually doesn't, but yeah.
I know. I'm being facetious.
But, you know, they've got beautiful things written up there, and they have no idea what it says. No.
Is the Om symbol Sanskrit, or is that something different?
No, it is Sanskrit, and yet it almost transcends even the language of Sanskrit. It is called the primordial sound.
Mm-hmm.
The letter itself is written, the lettering that we call Sanskrit is called Devanagari script, the Devanagari. And, you know, other languages use Devanagari, but, and there are... Each element of the Om symbol is symbolic. The main part of the letter is like a three,
mm-hmm.
numeral three. Well, the top half means this, the bottom half means that. Then there's a little sort of swirl out to the side, and that means that. And then there's like a half moon, and then there's a dot. It's all symbolic.
Mm-hmm. One would have to actually maybe construct the symbol in pieces in order to separate it, to see the different symbols that make up, just in this case as we are talking, make up the Om symbol.
Yes, oh, certainly, yes, and it's very beautiful to do.
Now, how different is that from, say, and again, I may be having you step outside of an area that you're knowledgeable of, but how different is that from, say, the characters that we see, say, in Chinese or Japanese writing, where you've got all these lines and swirls and things that make up a character? Is there a connection?
Good question, and it is beyond really my realm of study and expertise, but I mean, as I understand it, particularly in Chinese, so they're pictograms.
Mm-hmm, okay.
Sanskrit isn't like that. They're not pictograms, even though I said each element of, say, the Om symbol does have a meaning, a symbology to it.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't say any more about the letters of the alphabet, and I'm certainly not aware of that. That's not been a study.
Okay.
Yeah.
First of all, how many characters, as in the English alphabet, 26, and the Hebrew alphabet, 22, how many characters are there in the Sanskrit alphabet, if that's the right terminology?
I knew you were going to ask me that. I never retain that number.
Oh.
I don't get asked it very often. I can work it out. There's 16 vowel sounds, because you've got a, e, i, o. So you've got all those vowel sounds. Then you have five mouth positions. So I'll put them into English. There's the guttural, the palatal, the dental, the cerebral, the dental, and the labial. So that's the throat, the palate. You move up. So imagine down the throat, then we go up to the palate at the back, then the roof of the mouth, the cerebral, then the dental on the teeth, and then the labial at the lips.
Okay.
So there's five mouth positions. And then you have a voiced and unvoiced sound. So say guttural, ka, ka, ga, gha, and then a nasal nga. And each of the five mouth positions have that. So that's five fives of 25 plus your vowel sounds. Then you have semi-vowels, Ha, Ya, Ra, and Wa. Ha, Ya, Ra, La. Then you've got sibilants, and you've got Ha, Sha, Sha, and Sa. And then there's various other things like an anuswara and a ng and a visarga ha sound. And so there's 50-odd, I think.
Yeah. And my understanding, and again, my exposure to Sanskrit was through Paramahansa Yogananda's book, Autobiography of a Yogi. It's my metaphysical primer.
Yeah.
And I remember there was actually a chapter in that book talking about I think the way it was referred to as the inadequacies of the English language, because
yes,
there weren't enough letters or characters or what have you to adequately express all of the various and sundry sounds that could be made. And that's,
yes,
and some of them you just went through. And that leads me to believe also that in learning to speak the Sanskrit language, you've got to learn to use your mouth in a whole different way.
Absolutely. And that's a very, very good question. Yes, and you notice that teaching children, because, you know, you can teach them to read English and so on, and but then when you come to Sanskrit, it's far more precise, far more detailed, far more thorough, and you need to be clear on all the mouth positions, whether it's voiced or unvoiced. All the sibilants, they're different ones. There's a sha, a sha, and a sa, and a ha. The nasal sounds are they're all different. And it actually requires you to be present, to be precise. You need to be present. And that's another wonderful thing. It's the complete package.
So when we talk about the 50-odd characters of the Sanskrit language, and we talk about the different sounds that are made from each of these 50 different places, these and so forth, and obviously
yes,
starting to combine them into the words and the sentences and so forth, what study has been done from your experience over the years that shows the beneficial attributes of not just learning the writing, the written language, but learning to speak it? From your understanding, I would venture this is probably contained within the ancient wisdom teachings as you speak, that there is some benefit. What have you experienced personally? And what have you seen others experience?
That's another lovely question. What I've experienced personally is there's just an aligning. I'm really connecting with my experience here. There's just a sense of alignment and purity and wholeness. If I say something like, may all be happy, there's a prayer, may all be happy, may all be without disease, may all creatures see only good things and none be in misery of any sort. Now, that's beautiful in English, but if I say to you, om sarve bhavantu sukhina, sarve santu niramaya, sarve bhadrani pashantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet. There's just something else about that.
Well, I was certainly quite attentive to that.
Yeah. And then you can look into the etymology of all the words, and that's just another whole dimension as well. And then you go back and recite those Sanskrit words again with a new level of understanding and meaning. It just, the vibrations of them seem to go through the whole being if you're open and receptive to that. In fact, they've done studies with some yogis chanting for some hours, and they hooked them up to, you know, the machinery, MRIs or whatever they did, and they noticed that in chanting for 2 to 3 hours, nonstop, whole sides of the brain were activated and actually increased. That's, you can just do a simple internet search on that, those sorts of studies that they're doing. In my experience teaching, we were teaching the alphabet and some of the simple chants and prayers like that, and then the children were translating simple sentences and speaking simple sentences, like the elephant, you know, stands under a tree and the bird eats the bread, and, you know, simple things as you would learning any language, and fun things, and, you know, acting things out. And then it got increasingly more complex into stories, traditional stories. We noticed, colleagues of mine, and we didn't expect this, but over the years what we noticed was that it actually works on the mind itself, because in their other subjects like math or English or whatever, their results improved. Their mind was just clearer and they got better at what their other studies as well. It was one of those, we didn't see that coming, but it's obvious when it's pointed out. It was remarkable.
I know that here in Santa Barbara, there is there's a gentleman who is a part of, he's a Swami who is a sort of the branch. This is kind of the way I put this, that there are several branches of the same tree when it comes to these esoteric teachings that stem even to Sri Yukteswar, who was Paramahansa's guru. And here in Santa Barbara, it's the Self-Inquiry Life Fellowship down in, of course, Pacific Palisades in Los Angeles, Paramahansa's Self-Realization Fellowship. And I think there might be a third one. I'm not sure off the top of my head. Nonetheless, I've had a chance to interview him. He was telling me that there are schools in London that are teaching Sanskrit as part of the regular curriculum for this very purpose of raising a children. They're not teaching kids how what to think. They're teaching them they're teaching them Sanskrit to broaden their capacity to process information in, I'm going to speculate, in a higher way.
We were linked to one of the schools in London, and in fact the children sat the ones that opted for it sat the 11 plus international Sanskrit exam, which was held just this week in the school that I taught in Sydney. There were students still sitting that international Sanskrit exam, and it was the exam is set by one of those schools in London. I know them well. I know schools that do teach Sanskrit for different reasons. Some, it's an extension of a classics program. So if they're teaching Latin and Greek, they'll also teach Sanskrit for the ones that really want more. But increasingly in universities, I've seen, particularly in Germany, for example, Sanskrit is becoming very popular for people in the technology space, because it trains the mind and it actually works on the mind itself. It's like putting the mental processes through a washing machine or something. It just clears it all out. And that comes back to my experience. My view is that the word Sanskrita, which is actually the proper word, how to describe it is Sanskrita, means pure and perfectly formed. That's what it means. And when, for example, we are still and we hear that, you know, what can be described as the still small voice within, and it's often not in the language that we speak, so it's not before it's translated into English or German or whatever our normal vernacular is, it's just a knowledge, it's a knowing, and it's a still, and it comes in the form of like a still small voice, and it's always pure and perfectly formed. It never puts you wrong. And then it's translated into whatever language you speak and understand so that you can then act on that and do whatever. But I think there's two ways of understanding Sanskrit. There's Sanskrit and there's Sanskrit. There's the Sanskrit that is, you know, dictionaries and grammars and texts and so on and so forth. And then there's this, what they describe as the language of the universe, and it is pure and perfectly formed. And that, I think, the Sanskrit language that we recognize is a reflection, is the most accurate, pure reflection of that universal language, if you will. And when you approach it like that, of course it's going to clarify and purify the mind. Of course you're going to feel more in balance and aligned within yourself, and clearer and stronger and more connected. You're just connecting with something far greater.
And the interesting thing about this, from my observation, is that in spite of the fact that it has now sort of become, to use a modern vernacular, it's trending.
Yeah.
It's been trending, quite honestly, for thousands of years. This is nothing new. That just seems to me to be the case, what is old is new is old is new again. And that's fine. And that's wonderful. Because when Paramahansa came to the United States to spread his message, especially about meditation and yoga, he got a lot of blowback, as the term goes nowadays.
Yeah.
But he also received a great deal of support and encouragement and involvement by many, many people in these different practices, which I'm still working on today. I used to attend one of the SRF temples here in back in Phoenix, where I was born and raised. Been to the Pacific Palisades location here in California as well. Wow, what an awesome place! Just beautiful. And I know he went around the world, but that's my first exposure to Sanskrit. Do you think that? Well, first of all, let me ask, because you're there in Australia. What is the acceptance of teaching Sanskrit in the school systems there?
Well, it's so out there, mostly it sort of blows people's minds and they just don't know what to make of it, which is great because they, you know, their any reactions they may have tend to be sort of stopped in their tracks. Put it that way. and it's seen as a bit, in some quarters it would be seen as sort of irrelevant or just out there and, you know, why would you bother and just, sorry, where's my lunch? And they're onto something else, you know. It doesn't warrant much attention. Other people would see it in the linguistic landscape that, you know, all these languages are being taught in schools, particularly at the what we call the HSC level, which is, you know, 18-year-olds leaving high school. Different languages are taught. Sanskrit isn't, but, you know, so it could fit there. Look, generally, however, that's the sort of more negative side. But generally speaking, we found people were mightily impressed and very respectful of teaching Sanskrit. The school inspectors, because I was teaching in an independent non-government school, so we were inspected every 5 years, and the inspection process is thorough and rigorous. We had to sort of justify the time spent to do this, to teach this, but our results spoke for themselves, and our results in all the public exams spoke for themselves, and they were just usually very respectful of the richness and diversity in the curriculum of offering. Well, it wasn't just Sanskrit. We taught a lot of Shakespeare and beautiful music and all sorts of things. So they were very impressed by the standard of education, and that included Sanskrit. And other schools that we knew, other independent schools, said, you know, we wish we had the freedom to do the sort of thing you did. But, you know, so it varied. We didn't really have anyone come up to us and say, what the heck are you doing? This is crazy. I mean, most people knew enough, and especially it was one of the reasons I was keen to study at university level, because if someone came up to me and said, why are you studying Sanskrit? I could say, right, how long have you got? And I could actually answer the question with some authority.
Yeah.
Whereas if I was just a sort of gifted amateur, then you know, there's a certain credibility that isn't there, unfortunately, and that needn't be the case, but that's how it is. And certainly for the school, that was important, that we had the subject founded properly,
which we did. And again, I don't live nor have or have had lived in Australia, so I don't know about the answer to this question. From your observation, what level on, let's just say, a scale of 1 to 10.
Yeah.
1 being, we want, you keep that just as far away from us as possible, to 10 being, bring it on, we want it so badly, we can taste it. Where would be the comparison between Australia and, let's say, England, since we've spoken of the schools in London in particular, and the United States?
I was going to think about your question.
And don't be afraid, because you're over there, they can't get you.
I think there's probably a good solid fence sitting 5 somewhere,
okay,
you know, where
sure,
it's, yeah, whatever, as long as it doesn't impinge on my consciousness too much. You know, don't bug me.
Yeah.
I think it just comes down to that. You know, I wish I could have a more profound or amusing answer, because that's a great question. But really, you know, Sanskrit does require you to actually pay attention. Now, a lot of people, if they're not going to actually study the language, and fine, you know, that's one of the things in my book, I've drawn out some key meanings so people don't have to go and buy grammar books and go and find teachers and learn if they don't want to, but actually to open a doorway so that there's some connection to some of the meanings in Sanskrit rather than just hearing the sounds, because there is that beautiful level where you can listen to beautiful chanting and it does have an effect. It's, you know, everyone knows that. And that's probably the most common interface and experience people have with Sanskrit, is listening to some beautiful chant on YouTube, or, you know, the theme song to Battlestar Galactica or The Matrix or Star Wars. There's Sanskrit in those. But to go beyond that, you need some help. And most people, that's where everyone just says, sorry, I've got to go and, you know, prune the roses or can my kumquats. I've got something else to do. Because, you know, then that starts dropping off to who is actually going to learn. And that's okay. You don't have to. So, like I say, a good fence sitting 5, where it's lovely, it's beautiful. What an amazing language. But as long as you don't bug me any further and don't wake me up.
Yeah, and I find that very interesting. And my observations, having lived in the States all my life, what I find is, and it's, this is where I think that we really miss the boat, to say the, you know, to no pun intended there, is that the United States has such an attitude of individualism.
Yeah.
Both as a population split up of 350 to 400 million people, but also as a nation itself, that no, we're not going to learn from anybody else. We'll figure it out on our, you know, there's part of me that says that the United States is not a woman, is a man. Doesn't ask directions if it gets lost, and is not going to read the instructions for building something. And sure as heck isn't going to use ideas from other countries where it's worked just fine. And that's what really bothers me more than anything else about this country and, let's say, its educational system, in that if they incorporated Sanskrit, all right, as a means, as you have shared in your book, Conscious Confidence, as a means of broadening one's horizons and broadening them from the standpoint of not gathering more information, but of creating the capacity to assimilate that information in a way that is beneficial for the individual. I was challenged not too long ago. I'd love your observations on this. I was challenged not too long ago on my comments about being a very staunch proponent of education. I swear that everybody deserves to have an education.
Absolutely.
Now, I had a college professor say to me, no, everybody doesn't. I said, well, why not? He says, because some people are stupid. A college professor said that to me. But I was challenged in one of my interviews not too long ago by a James, last name is Purpura. He is he and his wife founded an organization here in the States called Powerful U.com.
Yeah.
And it's sort of personal growth and raising consciousness, dealing with the stuff of the past. And he says, well, what do you mean by education? And I said, well, and nobody's ever asked me that before. And I said, well, it's when an individual is exposed to information and experiences and individuals and situations that lift them up, that raise them up to a place where they are able to process that information in such a way, maybe in a critical thinking way, that helps them to fulfill and live out their life's purpose and make their own dreams come true, as we say on this program, about giving people choices and knowledge of those choices to help make their dreams come true.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that? And again, I did not throw into that mix of definition of what I meant by education. I didn't throw into the mix institutional education, first through 12 and post-secondary.
Yeah. I mean, that is the fundamental thing about a human being. It is why we're here, the evolution, and it does come back to education. At the school I taught, we were given the principles, give the children the best material, the finest and best material, have them in good company, and that's the good company of people, and also the good company within themselves of good thoughts and good feelings. That's the company they keep. And everything in appropriate measure. So not too much and not too little of any of it. So as we know, anything good, if it's out of measure, you know, if you don't eat broccoli all day, even though broccoli is great for you, you don't just only eat broccoli because then it's not good for you. So everything's in measure. So those three very simple principles, fundamental principles, that guided everything we did. And the school's a great success to this day as a result. But, you know, Sanskrit, one of the reasons for Sanskrit was because it is the finest. When you come to language and sound, it is the very finest. And if you're aiming to give the children the best, which you would in physical food, you're not going to give them junk food. You give them the best food. Well, the same with the mental food, the emotional food and spiritual food. You give them the very best and finest. And that is for education right through for all of us. And we're constantly learning and evolving. Otherwise, we just have the same set of ideas and they're just on a repeat cycle like a computer. And we're getting the same result, and people wonder why they can't seem to feel satisfied or happy. It's because they haven't been shown. They haven't been taught. So we do need knowledge. And frankly, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because there is some fundamental knowledge and information and principle there that may spark someone to go, aha, oh, I didn't know that, oh, and start seeing something and thinking about something in a different way. And the moment we start actually thinking in a different way, even just one aha moment, our life has changed in that moment. We tend to think of change my life and, oh, it's all, you know, incredible and this, all these sorts of things. But we only just need to have one aha moment where, oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, oh, that's interesting. Immediately, our life has changed from the pattern it was the moment before. Mm. And that's fundamental.
Well, I'm hoping, and again, I realize that in our country, I don't know what it's like in Australia in that regard, but in our country, you know, we have a huge stumbling block where we've got people who are really upset with the public school system and its inadequacies. And so we blame the teachers. We blame the administration, not enough money. And I'm getting tired of hearing, let's throw more money at it. I don't think that's the, if that were the answer, oh my God, we would have PhD kids coming out from 12th grade.
Yes.
If that was the answer. I don't think that's the answer. I think it's the curriculum. And unfortunately, and again, I don't know about the Australia and other parts of the world, but my God, we have so many other things that we supposedly have to teach our kids, like gun safety. And if someone comes on the campus, what do you do? And sex, whether it's abstinence training or how to put a condom on dealing with the whole paradigm of transgenderism. I don't want to even want to get into that because it's like all of this other stuff. It's like, where are the fundamentals? And to that end, let me ask you. I want to go into another area that I really do believe is associated with Sanskrit. Because you sort of alluded to it a little while ago, and I as I did as well. If they said that a particular school district is going to cut the curriculum,
yeah,
which courses would you say keep, and which courses would you say get rid of? I'm going to tell you my choices. I'd get rid of all the fundamental courses, and I would keep all of the elective courses, like music and art. And athletics, because in music especially, you're going to learn language and you're going to learn math and so forth. But so let me have you answer that question. Would you tend to agree with me, or would you have some other parameters that you would set up?
Well, there was about three questions in that question.
Sorry about that.
I would say anything to do with sound, because sound is so fundamental and sound is creative. That's one of the importance about Sanskrit. You need to keep that. So I agree with you that music and art, certainly, and I would say language. If it's a school, you need to teach English properly. And that is one of the things that seems to have gone by the wayside in many English-speaking countries, is we don't actually teach our own language properly anymore, which if you go to other countries like China, they spend years learning their own language thoroughly. We don't. We get children to a level of literacy and basically then say, there you go. You know, we don't actually teach grammar. That's seen now as an imposition and an old-fashioned structure and limiting on their creativity, but you're not actually providing students with the correct tools. And there's mental training that goes in that, and there's mental discipline. It's not just the grammar itself, it's the effect of that. And to then teach it well, then you need teachers who know their stuff and are inspired to teach it well. So there's a whole story there, but to go back to the fundamentals of education, you need to give the best. And if you have that as a guiding principle, then that will guide your choices of what is taught. The finest and the best. So the best music, the finest music, the best and finest language, the best and finest principles of behavior. And it's not telling people what, it's just that's the guiding principle of your choice. Mm-hmm. If you say that with food, the best and finest food, people don't have a problem. You start saying the best and finest mental food, music, art and all of that for children or for students, then what people understand by the best and the finest, well, that will be largely determined on what their experience is, and that's where the rot gets in, to be honest with you. It's not all about the teachers. It's not all about the money or the buildings and the equipment. I mean, what school do you want to be in? Our school principal used to put this to us as teachers. He said, would you rather have a child at some whiz-bang fantastic school that's got all the computers and the money and everything and all this, you know, and yet the teachers are sticking them in front of computers and expecting them to learn that way because that's the way we are now, you know, this is technology and we've got to keep pace with it. Or would you prefer to have a child sitting in a circle on the ground with Mother Teresa as the teacher sitting in the circle with a stick writing things in the sand because there's no blackboard, but the child's in the presence of Mother Teresa as the teacher? Which school would you prefer to have your child in?
Well, I can tell you, having actually been in the presence of Mother Teresa when she was in Phoenix back in the 80s, I would take the latter.
Exactly. Because we all know that the fundamental principle that we had at our school was a school is the meeting of teacher and pupil, right? You've got to imagine I'm pointing both my fingers and there's a space between. The school is a meeting between the teacher and the pupil, and in that space of that meeting, that is the school. And the question you have to ask yourself is, what is the quality of that meeting? What is the quality of that school in that meeting? Because it makes no difference about the buildings and the technology and the textbooks and frankly, the curriculum if you haven't got that meeting point right. And the fundamental thing is that the teacher must connect with the child. And depending on what you understand to be a human being, whatever your understanding is, that is what you will educate. If you only see that human, that person, your understanding of human being is basically a physical body with a bit of sort of brain activity and possibly some psychology thrown in, especially when they're having problems, bring in the psychologist, then that's what fundamentally your education system is going to be based on and will look like. And you only need to see what's happening.
Yeah.
That you're getting the out projection of what people actually understand of what a human being is and is capable of. Because if you understand a human being to be a manifestation of the supreme consciousness of the universe with a body, a physical body, a mind, a heart, and a spirit, your education system is going to be quite different because you'll be educating the whole child.
It is something that we are looking at here on this program. Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're talking with Sarah Main, and we're talking about her latest work, and that has to do with conscious confidence. And we certainly hope that you will go to that website. It is consciousconfidence.com. Sarah Main is my guest, and we are discussing Sanskrit. I want to get into that area I was referring to just a few moments ago where we sort of got a little, just slightly sidetracked. in Indian teaching, from India, ladies and gentlemen, you have a musical, let me rephrase this. In the West, you have basically 8 octaves. And you have whole notes, half notes, quarter notes, eighth notes, sixteenths, et cetera, et cetera. You have all these other things. Whereas in India, and I want to find out from you how this relates to Sanskrit, because I do think it does, although I could be wrong, you have ragas.
Ragas, yes.
And you have a much more... I'm trying to think of the right phraseology here. You have a much deeper structure foundation to work from than just the 8 octaves or the 8 notes in the Western musical scale. Although you do, I know you have your sharps and your flats and so forth, but there's so much more in the music of India than any other that I can think of, although I have heard that there was sort of an explanation of some of the Middle Eastern music and singing in particular, the way that their tones move around and what have you. What can you share with us about the connection between, in this case, Indian music and Sanskrit?
Well, I'm certainly, Indian music is not an area of expertise for me. I do know some musicians and a composer who works with ragas and modes and things. There's a lot of beautiful texts and chants, and of course all the swamis and the yogis, and they chant and they use, they're utilizing all the musical systems in the Indian music, and that's probably as far as I can say.
Okay.
Like I said, my expertise really and my training was in more the etymology, although we did chant and recite Sanskrit, but it wasn't really delving into that side of things. I have done some study into the natural octave, so I know there's more to what we understand of the octave, our own sort of so-called Western musical octave. I did do some study for quite a while on the natural octave, and there's a whole dimension that isn't in our current understanding. And it is like another whole level of consciousness and interest and resonance. Mm-hmm. But you need to sort of go into that side of things. And the modes is one of the ways into that.
Well, I know that it's music is quite a profound element in our lives.
Yes.
That for me, I did a little research on what was called the Mozart effect.
Yes.
And I read some articles on it, and I thought, oh, it was very interesting. And I've talked with musicians. I've talked with, for example, Jonathan Goldman. Who's been on this program many, many times in that regard, as well as another gal, I believe Erica Miller is her name, and she was a concert violinist until a car accident, unfortunately, ended that career. Mm-hmm. But then I read some other articles poo-pooing the idea that, oh, no, that's hokum and what have you, you know. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, there's got to be some truth to that somewhere, because otherwise they wouldn't have done it. And then, of course, one of my first questions is, well, why Mozart? Why not Bach or Beethoven or Shostakovich or Rachmaninoff or any of the other great composers of the last 200 or 300 years? And yet, I was a member of a classical music CD club back in the 80s and early 90s, and I've still got those CDs. And I used to throw one of those CDs on the player, and I'd get home from work, and I'd come in the trailer where I was living at the time, and I'd crash on the couch, and I'd fall asleep. And I think I woke shortly after sunset. But it was so relaxing. It was wonderful. Yeah. And they're saying that music, in this case classical music, has such a profound effect, and that was the reason that I wanted to kind of go down that road with you, especially when it came to Sanskrit. I mean, if you're singing, if you are chanting these Sanskrit, you're choosing, or the notes have been chosen in these chants already, then there's got to be a reason. I mean, and again, sometimes we do tend to overthink things. I will be the first to admit that. But that really was the impetus for my question.
Well, I mean, the Mozart, we when we taught the finest music, we taught Mozart, Handel, Haydn, Bach, but we certainly made sure the children were exposed to the greats of Mozart, either just listening to recordings of them, or if there was an orchestra, we'd go and take them and listen to concerts if we could. Otherwise, certainly the choral music, everyone sang. Singing was part of it. The key tenets in the school were singing Sanskrit and Shakespeare. And all the children, no matter what their academic level or abilities, that was immaterial. I had a girl with Down syndrome in my class. She learned Sanskrit. Now, she may not have studied grammar because we were still teaching her to read English, and that was important. But she learned the prayers, and she learned them just like everyone else, and it was beautiful. and that's available to everyone. And so the sound and this thing of we can overthink things, and that there's more truth in that than we realize, you know, and everyone's got to have everything tested before they'll even take it on board. Well, test it yourself in your own experience. Fall still and put on some different types of classical music, for example, and just see the effect, observe the effect within yourself. And it doesn't make one better than the other, but Mozart, there is just something about it. And if you've played Mozart in any capacity, I've played the piano and I also learned the harp. And it was through the harp that I ended up down this route with confidence. My harp teacher, you know, who's performed the Mozart flute and harp concerto many times, she said it's technically difficult, but there is every musician who's played Mozart, whether you're an amateur or professional, there is something about Mozart where you can't hide. You can't cover it up with, you know, something. It's just got this purity, this potency about it. And do you remember the director of the movie Amadeus? He didn't know, was this Milos Friedman or someone? Mm-hmm. He didn't know anything about Mozart, and he took on this movie Amadeus, and he sat with headphones on and listened to hours of Mozart, and he just was completely transformed, and he said, I get it. Now I know what people are talking about with Mozart.
Yeah.
It's, you know, genius is genius. Are you going to define it? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know? And Sanskrit's genius, you know, it's just what it is.
Well, and see, that's the other thing too, is that I'm curious as to what civilization is responsible for Sanskrit, or at least what's the tradition say?
Well, it's an ancient... I'll just answer that simply, that it's an ancient Indian language. The language that we know is an ancient Indian language, and the wisdom traditions, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, which is a section, just as the Bhagavad Gita is a section of this massively long epic poem called the Mahabharata, which is over 100,000 verses of Sanskrit, and the Bhagavad Gita is just one little section of it, and it's a beautiful story and it's just magnificent. There's the Ramayana, there's, you know, there's poetry, there's plays, there's texts about philosophy, psychology, medicine, architecture, science, astronomy. You know, it's just a vast corpus of literature, all in Sanskrit and ancient. You know, this whole thing of what's old is new again. Mm-hmm. All the wisdom is there, and it's not a case of looking backwards. It's a case of looking at it afresh and seeing that the wisdom is timeless. That's why I called it conscious confidence, a timeless wisdom, because it is in fact timeless. We can say ancient, but that puts a limit on it, really. It's timeless, and it's a case of discovering it afresh now and the relevance now.
So I always had a real hard time with the phrase, the term that was used, especially in metaphysical circles, when they would talk about the New Age movement.
Yeah.
And I'm going, new? What's new about it? Could you explain that to me? We've rediscovered it. Okay, that's fine. But it's a very old concept, and it's very old traditions and rituals, which certainly I'm a firm believer that we need to incorporate back into our societies, into our communities. And to that end, you talked about the chanting of Sanskrit, and I'm not sure if these were songs, if these were mantras, and for the purposes of meditation or triggering certain parts of the brain to greater capacity or what have you. And I'm wondering about that in terms of finding these different musical compositions, I'll call them, okay? It's loosely, extremely loosely translated from my perspective.
Yeah.
What about that? I mean, you talked about, for example, what was it, the Upanishads? It's got 100,000 verses.
The Mahabharata.
Mahabharata. Yes. I mean, then of course, there's also the sutras and on and on and on.
Yes.
But what about from some of these ancient wisdom teachings, certain chants that are that have been written to do just that, it's sort of like it's a medicine, if you will,
yes.
a remedy for memory loss, or I want to increase my capacity to understand certain things, so I'm going to spend, even if it's 10 minutes every day, just chanting this little thing. I mean, what is it? Om Ame Padme Om. Anyway, it doesn't matter. What about that in terms of finding these kinds of things? Is that something that is available? Is there some place we can go to find something like that where, if we're so inclined, we could activate those parts of ourselves through these chants?
Absolutely. And it's very powerful. There were 9 basic invocations or prayers that we made sure all the children knew, and certainly as an adult I was taught them, and I've taught adults and children, and they're just invocations to some of the main Upanishads, the prayers. They can be referred to as mantras, they can be referred to as prayers, they can be referred to as dedications or invocations. And they set an intention within yourself before you embark on an activity, for example. They clarify the purpose, they get the mind still and centered, so that we're not just importing a whole lot of mental and emotional baggage that we've, you know, been thinking about for the last 3 hours into the next activity. You actually start the activity in the present moment freshly. Find them. These days we're lucky with the internet. To be honest with you, you could go and do an internet search and ask, look for a simple prayer, a basic prayer, and there's usually some translation that you can play. It's not always easy to follow. It depends. That's a bit variable. And there's usually a transliteration of how to read the characters. They're put into English letters underneath. In my book, I've done that. I've done the Devanagari lettering, and then I've written it out in English transliteration. And there's a pronunciation guide at the back of the book.
Mm.
So if you were sufficiently interested. But, you know, there are simple prayers like Asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritam gamaya. And then they usually end, most of the prayers end with Om Shanti, 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 which is Om, and then that's untranslatable. And then peace, peace, peace. And the triple peace designation usually refers to peace in the physical world, peace in the mental world, peace in the spiritual world, sort of peace and peace and peace everywhere. Mm. And that's always at the end of most of the prayers, actually. And then you can learn different lilts. There are different lilts to these. Some of them are set, but some of them are a bit freer, and different traditions will have different lilts.
Well, I know that there's one phrase that most people do know and use quite often in either greeting or departure from certain gatherings and so forth, and that's namaste. Which is usually, I honor the place in you which resides the divine, and so forth and so on, something along those lines.
Yeah.
My present wife and I, we associated with a gentleman who was actually a co-author of a book entitled The Jewel in the Lotus, Sunyata Saraswati, and a very fascinating gentleman. And he actually gave her name that she has chosen and actually changed to legally. And I have been pronouncing it as long as I've known her as Amrita. But my Vedic astrologer keeps telling me it's Amrita or Amrita. And it's like, okay. And there is a there is an intention in the proper pronunciation, isn't there?
Yes, proper pronunciation is important. It's very important. I mean, it's not valued these days, even speaking English. But say, for example, that word is amrita. The emphasis in English, we have a stress pattern which is penultimate. So we tend to, our English stress system, we put the stress on the second last syllable of a word. So we would say amrita because that's the second last syllable of the word, the penultimate mm-hmm. syllable. Mm-hmm. But in Sanskrit, it would be amrita, amrita. See how I'm putting the stress on the first one?
Yes, uh-huh.
And it's an a, the vowel sound is an a rather than an a. There's no a in Sanskrit. People talk about Sanskrit and that's, you know, understandable, but it's actually a Sanskrita. And it's amrita, and it means eternal, not death.
Absolutely.
Amrita.
I've also heard the translation nectar of the goddess.
Yes.
Which I like too. And I, having read the autobiography of Yogaswami so many times and read the story of the Tiger Swami so many times, while we first were together for the first 4, 5, 6 years, I never changed my name legally to this, but I went by the name of the tiger in the story. And the tiger's name was Raja Begum, which supposedly was translated Prince Princess. So I just took on the first part. And
Raja.
I went by Raja for many years there. And I've thought about it, but I liked it at the time, but even to this day, it doesn't quite fit, at least in my head. But nonetheless, it's interesting how certain words do get into our language. And then, of course, again, it's the whole aspect, too, of the mispronunciation thereof. It's one of the things, and again, I don't mean any disrespect to anybody's relatives who served on Ellis Island and helping the immigrants to come across, but, you know, the height of disrespect is to say, I can't pronounce your name, so I'm going to change it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, I asked you this before we started. I want to make sure that I have your name pronounced correctly. And for all I know, it's not Sarah, it's Sarah Ha, you know, with an H at the end, you know. And maybe it's not pronounced Maine. It could be Mani, for all I, you know. But to me, it's the height of respect to learn how to pronounce someone's name.
Yes.
And to refer to them in that fashion. That's why I've gone to the simple way, and I just say, just refer to me as Dr. D. That's so easy.
Yeah.
This is a fascinating...
Get to the essence,
exactly. This is a fascinating conversation we're having, and you've got a very interesting book. One of the things that I look forward to is finding... especially in Audible, because it makes it so much easier to read, obviously.
Yes.
And I still consider that reading, okay?
Also, yes, absolutely. I'm a great consumer of Audible.
See, I was listening to Audibles before they were Audibles.
Yeah.
When I was a kid growing up, I was legally blind, and so I was a member of the Talking Books for the Blind and Recordings for the Blind. One was for textbooks for school. The other one was recreational reading.
Right.
And that was where I first read Autobiography of a Yogi, was on these discs that was spun at 1 7/8 RPM.
Oh, wow.
So you can get 45 minutes of reading on one side of a disc. it's one of those things where... listening to it. So that's where I want to go to real quickly here before we wrap things up, because I know it's we're fast approaching the end of our time together, and I thank you so much for giving us so much time here. But what about, you made the reference to going to YouTube and finding these. I actually was guided by my Vedic astrologer to go to the YouTube because there's a prayer there with Lakshmi having to do with money and prosperity and abundance. Mm. And then there are all kinds of others as well. Can it be equally beneficial just to sit quietly and listen if you're having trouble with the pronunciations? Is that better than frustrating yourself and sort of defeating the purpose of of listening in the first place?
Absolutely. Look, anything's better than being stuck listening to your own negative thoughts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Right? Okay. So if we start from that basis, then absolutely listening, that is bringing in some new sound. And if you're going to bring any new sound in, listen to some Sanskrit beautifully pronounced. Why not? There's more to it than, you know, ultimately there's more to it than just the sounds. That's why coming back to the actual meanings is so fundamentally transformative, and that's what I've done in the book, is try and open up some of the meanings and just to reconsider things. That's one of the reasons we studied Sanskrit in the philosophy groups I was in, and these sort of meditation and spiritual groups, was if you're going to reflect or meditate on a passage of Sanskrit, which is what we did. We took statements from the Upanishads and we actually meditated on them, so they repeated in the mind. You jolly well better have A, the pronunciation correct, because it's quite a concentrated exercise, so you want to make sure it's not incorrect. And you also want to have some sense of the meaning. It wasn't just about repeating the sounds. You needed to actually have an understanding of what you were saying. And then in the light of the truth in those words, there was an opportunity to either realize some greater understanding of the meaning and also highlight where the limits were within yourself to realizing that meaning. So it had a sort of a twofold effect, if you like, highlighted limits on the one side and realize an aspect of the meaning on the other. And so a lot of time was spent on making sure that the Sanskrit was accurate and that we had some deeper understanding of the meaning. And that meant clarifying, you know, if you take there's an example in the book, that one word, A-double-L, all in English, in Sanskrit, sarva, it's a little word. It appears everywhere, certainly in the philosophical spiritual texts, innocuous really. And we think, all, yeah, I know what all means. But do you? A meaning is what it does. And I was going through this exercise of researching all the meanings, and before we were going to meditate on this statement, and the word all was in there. And I got to the point and I thought, oh, I've looked this word up so many times. And I thought, no. At that point, the discipline came in. I thought, no, the discipline in this exercise is to look each word up. So I looked up all yet again. I even knew the page number in the dictionary. I didn't have to look it up. And I read every single listing, and there's many, many definitions of all in the Sanskrit to English dictionary. And I read each one with full attention. And as I was reading, it was like peeling back, excuse me, the layers of the limitations I had on the meaning of sarva, of all. And all doesn't mean, it doesn't just mean a lot. It means all. It means everything down to the minutest atom, up to the greatest aspect of the universe. All is all. Everything's included. And I knew that from experience as I was researching that word. And that's just one teeny weeny word. And that was the power. So when I hear the word sarva, the meaning of it means all. And I have that as an experiential meaning. It's not a concept.
You know, you're the more you speak about this, the more questions I've got. But I can't keep going here. We'll have to set up another time to do this, because this is just
Absolutely.
So fascinating. But I remember when an Islamic imam was on one of my programs that I was producing, and we got into the conversation of Allah. And he said, do you know what the true definition of Allah is? And it's two words that are put together. And one means one thing and the other means the other. And the gist of, and I'm boy, let me tell you, no, again, I really don't want to disrespect anybody here. But the gist of what I'm remembering is that the phrase Allah is paramount to nothingness. That there's nothing there.
Mm.
And that's not to say that there is no divine, that there is no creator. It was the way that it was phrased that it had to do with the description. And I thought, wow, that's one word. That's one word that we don't even understand the meaning of.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And then I think about all of the Old Testament references to God, Elohim, and on and on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. Sarah. Yeah.
Yes.
You know.
By the way, 52 letters.
52. Oh, yes, a full deck. That's very good. Yep. How appropriate. Yep. They knew back then. Sarah Main, I want to thank you so much for this time. I definitely want to get back together with you. You are fast approaching as we continue here, and we're just about to wrap up our program. This interview is now approaching either the first or second longest interview I have ever done on this program. And that's just fine. The podcast people can go to and listen to the whole thing. You better. She's got some great stuff. Go to consciousconfidence.com. That's the title of the book as well as the website. And we certainly hope that people will avail themselves. And, you know, should you ever, jump on a slow boat to, I don't know what they say from Australia, because here in the States it's a slow boat to China.
China. We call it a long-haul flight.
A long-haul flight. Should you ever take one of those? Or you could take a bunch of puddle jumpers flights. You know, you could do that too. And go the other way. We'd love to have you in studio. Should you ever find yourself out here in Santa Barbara to continue this conversation. But hey, we'll take Skype too.
Okay. Well, that would be absolutely wonderful. And thank you for the opportunity. I so appreciate your absolutely marvelous questions. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I'd love to continue it. As you know, we could talk for hours.
Yes, we could.
I'd love to meet you as well.
That would be wonderful. Before I let you go, first of all, I want to remind our listeners that you need to go to the podcast at SoundCloud, which is the initial place. Click on that little, when you're listening to the interviews, click on the grocery cart. It'll take you to our guest website. And in this case, it'll take you to consciousconfidence.com and Sarah Main's website, and find out more about her and the work she's doing. And there's just so much on her website you can check out. It's just so cool. And I have three final questions for you that I ask all of my guests.
Yes.
Even when they return, I sometimes re-ask the questions because, hey, sometimes the answers have changed. And the first one is, who is Sarah Main?
Who is Sarah Main? Sarah Main is, at this point, journeying through the universe and bringing forward the best of what she was given. And I was given the very best. And my endeavor is to offer that to everyone in a way that is of use to them.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I would especially love what's coming forward to land with 18 to 30-year-olds and allow them to find certainty and confidence in the wisdom that is ever available in the wisdom traditions. And it is available, and it has always been available, and it's accessible and relevant and practical and simple. And I would love for them to transform their lives and found them on real foundations of wisdom and knowledge.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
To teach the truth.
Sarah Main, again, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. And we do look forward to having you back again in the not too distant future to share your wisdom with us through the work that you've been doing, the study, the practice, and also to share with us during this year, 2020, the year of perfect vision. I also thank you for listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, as we give you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I already feel like like my brain has, and I'm not trying to be funny here, but it just, it's like, wow, I just feel like it's really sort of opened up a little bit in certain areas. It's like a greater capacity for appreciation and understanding and all of those good things of life. And to that end, as we come to the end of the program, I thank everyone for listening. And until our next broadcast and podcast, love to Lal.